Last class, we had a discussion that involved looking at an image of Republican Rome. And there we got really only a small glimpse of what is quite a long history, a 500-year history, that has dramatic qualities to it. The political structures that we looked at, the political structures that emerge in Republican Rome, give rise to certain power distributions within, on the one hand, intentionally created institutions, and on the other hand, through unintended consequences of giving power to certain figures that then emerge to challenge the original power structures of Rome. So, on the one hand, you have consuls and the Senate coming into friction with very powerful generals who wish to more or less buck the status quo. The power structure that we find in Republican Rome is not really anything like Athenian-style democracy, but it's not a power structure that is dominated entirely by the elite either. And that's true as we get closer and closer to the time of Julius Caesar and ultimately the end of the Roman Republic. Republican Rome shows us how political institutions and political dynamics within a given system tend to evolve over time with the ever-present factor of political struggle between classes and between individuals. And the slow absorption of the Roman citizenry into the power structures that governed Rome over time are testimony to that fact. Ultimately, the civil wars that erupt around the time of Caesar are really mostly struggles between powerful factions that have varying allegiances. But those allegiances can be, on the one hand, to conservative privilege, in other words, keeping conservatives in their power positions, or they can be allegiances to a wider Roman population. And often that meant that those factions that had those allegiances were trying to change the power structures as they existed. Republican Roman politics is a form of politics which is, or is a form of republicanism which is anti-monarchical. But it's an anti-monarchical system that is contained and relatively restricted. And so it avoids the kind of direct democracy, even though its politics involves the people. And the degree to which that containment and that restriction of Roman republicanism starts to be challenged, and the degree to which it starts to unravel, is also the degree to which the republic itself descends into civil war and its very existence is threatened. So, like I said in the earlier lectures, there is this very delicate balance between all of these institutions, classes, and peoples. And once that balance comes into question too rapidly, it's not as if that balance never changed over the course of the Roman Republic, it certainly did. But at the end of the first, or near the end of the first century, as the challenges to that balance become greater and more intense, the possibility of civil war increases exponentially. Now, despite the civil wars and the tumultuous politics of the Republican period, we have to emphasize its considerable significance. In its 500 years of history, certain institutional features become very well embedded in the political structure. And even after the fall of Caesar, even as the Republic crumbles and we have the emergence of the Empire, many of those structures and those institutions and those Republican political forms, the ones we've been describing, remain in place. You still have senates in the Roman Empire following the Republic. You still have consuls, tribunes. All of these things stay in place. They are manipulated by the emperor from Augustus forward. There's no doubt about it. But it is significant that the emperor believes that those institutions must stay in place and they must at least take on the appearance of being respected in order for the emperor's political legitimacy to stay in place. And it is also significant to think that the empire, following the republic, stayed in place for another 500 to 600 years. That may have something to do with the tenacity and the longevity of the republican institutions as they were devised under the republic 500 years previous to the empire. But besides all of these institutions and these varying configurations and conflicts between different classes and individuals in Rome, there's also something quite unique and remarkable about Rome that is not dissimilar from ancient Athens, and that is its prevailing notion of citizenship. This is also something that comes down to us over time. Earlier in one of the lectures, I said I was going to talk a bit more about liberty and citizenship, and this is my opportunity to do so when we talk about the Roman tradition. Rome, like Athens, had a very powerful notion of citizenship, and it's one I think we can get, we could describe its various facets, or we could try to get at it by relating a typical Roman story or legend about a Roman citizen. The story I want to convey to you is taken really from fiction on Rome. It's a true story in its basic contours, but the details of it are played up a fair amount by the fictional author from whom I've taken it. But that's really okay for our purposes, because Roman history ultimately is not really very similar to modern historians' work. Roman history is about storytelling. Roman history has always been, ancient history in general, has always been about telling a story that is, well, loosely aligned to the facts, but more importantly is giving us a lesson about the kind of behavior that we should engage in. And very often, storytelling or history was used as a way to re-impress upon Roman citizens what it meant to be Roman and what Roman citizenship should mean to them. So the story that I want to tell is quite relevant to us, and then it gives us a snapshot of what Romans understood their own status of citizenship to mean. So, once upon a time, there was a very bad and nasty king of Syria named Antiochus. Even though Syria was a rich kingdom, King Antiochus IV lusted after the neighboring kingdom of Egypt. So King Antiochus invaded Egypt, captured Pelusium, marched down the delta to Memphis, captured that, and began to march up the other side of the delta towards Alexandria. Having ruined the country and the army, the brothers Ptolemy and their sister wife, Cleopatra II, had no choice but to appeal to Rome for help against King Antiochus, Rome being the best and the greatest of all nations, and everyone's hero. To the rescue of Egypt, the Senate and the people of Rome, being in better accord in those days than we could believe possible now, or so the storybooks say, sent their noble, brave consular, Gaius Papilius Lannus. Now, any other people in any other country would have given its hero a whole army. But the Senate and the people of Rome gave Lannus only 12 lictors and 2 clerks. However, because it was a foreign mission, the lictors were allowed to wear red tunics and put axes in the bundles of rods. So Lannus was not completely unprotected. Off they sailed in a little ship and came to Alexandria just as King Antiochus IV was marching up the canopic arm of the Nilus towards the great city wherein cowered the Egyptians. Clad in his purple bordered toga and preceded by his 12 crimson-clad lictors, all bearing the axes in the bundles of their rods, Lannus walked east. Now he was not a young man, so as he went he leaned upon a tall staff, his pace as placid as his face. Since only the brave and the heroic and noble Romans built decent roads, he was soon walking through thick dust. But was Papilius deterred? No, he just kept on walking until near the huge hippodrome in which the Alexandrians like to watch the horse races, he ran into a wall of Syrian soldiers and had to stop. King Antiochus IV of Syria came forward and went to meet Laenas. Rome has no business in Egypt, the king said, frowning awfully and direfully. Syria has no business in Egypt either, said Laenas, smiling sweetly and serenely. Go back to Rome, said King Antiochus. Go back to Syria, said Laenas. But neither of them moved a single inch. You are offending the Senate and the people of Rome, said Laenas, after a while of staring into the king's fierce eyes. I have been ordered to make you return to Syria. The king laughed out loud, and he laughed and he laughed. And how are you going to make me go home? He asked. Where is your army? I have no need of an army, King Antiochus, said Laenas. Everything that Rome is, has been, and will be, is standing before you here and now. I am Rome, no less than Rome's greatest army. And in the name of Rome, I say to you a further time, go home to Syria. No, said King Antiochus IV. So Gaius Papilius Laenas stepped forward, moved sedately, and he used the end of his staff to trace a circle in the dust all the way around the person of King Antiochus IV, who found himself standing inside Laenas' circle. Before you step out of this circle, King Antiochus, I advise you to think again, said Laenas. And when you do step out of it, be facing east and go home to Syria. The king said nothing. The king did not stir. Laenas said nothing. Laenas did not stir. Since Laenas was a Roman and did not need to hide his face, his sweet and serene countenance was on full display. But King Antiochus hid his face behind a curled and wired wig beard, and even then could not conceal its thunder. Time went on, and then, still inside the circle, the mighty king of Syria turned on his heel to face east and stepped out of the circle in an easterly direction and marched back to Syria with all his soldiers. Now this story is embellished. It's clearly embellished. But what it reveals about Roman citizenship, I think, is quite direct and on the mark. To be a citizen of Rome was not a passive affair. It involved putting the dignity of Rome before one's own dignity. And indeed, one enhanced one's own dignity by enhancing Rome's dignity. This was as true for the peasant soldier as it was for the consul general. One's well-being as a citizen and as a person was intimately linked to the fate of his or her native Rome. And it was this sense of liberty that Roman historians like Cicero are always talking about. Liberty, in this case, is the capacity of all classes of citizens to express and enhance the full dignity of Rome. And it's only as a result of this liberty that Rome itself could become great. So we have this very robust notion of citizenship active in Rome and active in all of its representatives. Now, why do I tell you all this? Because after we skip over the tail end of the Roman Empire in this course, which we inevitably must do, and as we skip over the feudal period, which we also must do, our attention is focused on the revival of republican thought, ultimately, in two instances. First, in the instance of the Renaissance, and then in the instance of absolutist France and the Enlightenment period. Basically, we're starting from the 15th century forward, when there is, as the word Renaissance suggests, a rebirth of ancient thought. And what we want to focus on is our political theorists. And so while your book mentions several political theorists, here we're going to focus on two, Niccolò Machiavelli and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. In both these cases, and these are really the headline political theorists in your text, these are the ones you will encounter in your 2900 course next year. In both these cases, these thinkers struggle with the idea of how the sense of liberty and citizenry that inhabited Rome could be captured again in their respective ages. So let's take Machiavelli first. Why talk about Machiavelli? What does he bring to our discussion of politics? Machiavelli lived in a very interesting time, one that in the study of political science is often characterized as a kind of transitionary period to modern politics. It's understood as the transition from feudal or ancient politics to modern politics. And you have no doubt heard of the phrase to be Machiavellian. And that typically means to engage in politics in a kind of detached, cold-hearted, cold-blooded, calculated fashion. In this understanding of Machiavelli, he's understood to be the first kind of political science at the outset of the modern period, and he's the one who putatively articulated the idea that the ends justify the means. In other words, in politics, it's necessary to do whatever you must do to attain your ultimate goal. And while that is certainly part of Machiavelli's thought, it is a very small part of his political thinking. And in fact, much of his work, as your textbook points out, your David Held textbook points out, is devoted to reviving the Republican tradition and the Republican spirit in Italian city-states of especially the 15th and 16th century. Machiavelli was a civil servant for the Florentine government for 14 years, a period in which Florence managed more or less to keep its liberty. It wiggled out of the control of monarchy, heredity, and outside political control. It avoided the authority of the Pope. It evaded the French, the Spanish, the Holy Roman Empire. And indeed, it even evaded its own Florentine aristocracy, the Medici's, the Medici family in particular. In that period, the period in which Machiavelli worked for the Florentine government, Florence had before it, although admittedly for a short time, a window of republican liberty. Now Machiavelli, who would eventually be fired from his position, he would be tortured, released, forced into retirement, and ultimately marginalized from political society in Florence, wrote of the possibilities for Florence, or a Florentine-like republic, to retain or acquire republican glory and greatness. Machiavelli's work has become famous because of the notion of being Machiavellian. But its real significance is its revival of republican thought and practice buried deep in, especially, Roman history. It doesn't just draw on Roman history, but predominantly, in fact, he draws on Roman republican history. He wants what he thinks is a weak Florentine political system and a weak citizenry to attain many of the attributes of Cicero's mixed constitutional republic, which is one of the reasons I got you to read Cicero's work on government and on the republic. He uses history in his works, The Prince and the Discourses, to praise a constitutionally mixed political arrangement, quite similar to the one Cicero holds up, and also to praise the idea of virtue. Virtue roughly translates, V-I-R-T-U, roughly translates into our contemporary notion of virtue, but it's not the same. The contemporary notion of virtue takes the wrong tone. It takes a moral tone, and that's not quite what's meant by virtue. What Machiavelli really means by virtue are the ideas that we've covered in this class in relation to Roman dignitas and Roman bravery in the face of outside external threats. In other words, maintaining one's liberty, acting in the face of fortune, and trying to put one's country before oneself are what mark the individual with virtu. He believed in the necessity for this kind of dignitas, this virtu, as much for the citizenry as he did for the prince and for the aristocracy and for the magistrates. In other words, for all the members of Florentine society, he believed a lesson in virtu, a lesson in citizenship, and a lesson in republican liberty was of the highest order. So what Leonis, in the story I told, what Leonis embodied in terms of greatness, bravery, dignity, he desired for his own city-state, for Florence. For Florence to survive in what was a fairly ravenous political environment of the world of France, of the Holy Roman Empire, of the Papal Empire, of the Spanish, everybody trying to get a piece of his beloved Florence. It was the right sense of citizenship that was necessary, the right sense of liberty, and the right sense of autonomy that was necessary for Florence to both achieve its independence and maintain its independence over time. So Machiavelli, in trying to move through this transitionary period, it's very often the Renaissance city-states are very often understood politically as a transition, like I said, from the feudal to the modern era. Machiavelli is not necessarily looking forward, but very importantly, he's looking backwards. And that speaks volumes to the idea that republican traditions in Athens and more particularly in Rome, matter as the future unfolds. So let's move to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau is also an extraordinary author, like Machiavelli, but he is quite a different kettle of fish from Machiavelli. Also a Republican, but in a different way. His context was Republican Geneva in the mid-18th century, but he also looked on events in absolutist France, dominated by a monarch, and on events in capitalist England, which was a political entity that was slowly transforming its own society into the detached, modern, liberal, democratic state that would lead to the Anglo-American tradition in which we live. We'll talk more about that as the semester advances. Your textbook makes quite clear that Rousseau also believes in the rebirth of the citizen along distinctly republican lines. Rousseau, like Machiavelli, believed in a mixed constitution. The difference is that within that mixed constitution, Rousseau believed in a much stronger role for the people, a much stronger role than Machiavelli ever conceived. For Rousseau, there should be executives and there should be legislative parts in any system of government. And we'll say more about executives and legislatives again as the semester progresses. But the ultimate sovereignty, the ultimate right to rule for Rousseau lies with the people. It lies with citizens. And here Rousseau really means it. Legislators can draft laws and executives can enact laws, but only the citizenry, only the people can rule, ultimately. And just to give you an idea of this, here's what Rousseau says about representative government. He has some things to say about the system of government that is evolving in England during his time. And keep in mind, he's effectively talking about the general contours of our own democracy. This is what he thinks of it. Sovereignty cannot be represented for the same reason that it cannot be alienated, given away. It consists essentially in the general will, and the will does not allow of being represented. It is either itself or something else. There is nothing in between. The deputies of the people, neither are nor can be its representatives. They are merely its agents. They cannot conclude anything definitively. Any law that the populace has not ratified in person is null. It is not a law at all. The English people believes itself to be free. It is greatly mistaken. It is free only during the election of members of Parliament. Once they are elected, the populace is enslaved. It is nothing. The use the English people makes of that freedom in the brief moments of its liberty certainly warrants their losing it. In other words, for Rousseau, representative government is slavery. Representative government is not freedom in any way, because people do not participate in that government structure. Rousseau appeals to the citizen that will have self-respect, that will have dignity and verve, the kind of verve that we saw in the story with Leonis. For Rousseau, all citizens must have such qualities if society is to be governed appropriately. But unlike Machiavelli, your textbook is probably right to tip Rousseau into the developmental republicanism category. So we would probably put Machiavelli in the protective republicanism category and Rousseau into developmental republicanism. Rousseau believes in the liberty of citizens as good in and of itself. In other words, the liberty of citizen is not just to serve the state, but it is a good development in and of itself. In fact, he envisions the optimal political arrangement to be a very small one, that could exist in a city-state like Geneva. And indeed, he feels that if you go above the level of the city-state, a small city-state, direct democracy is no longer possible. So you need a scenario, you need a political scenario in which all citizens can participate, and no citizen is ultimately subservient to another. Now, your textbook is going to give more description of these rather monumental authors, but you need to get a flavor of them for now. And what you need to think about is the ways in which Machiavelli and Rousseau and others fortify republican thinking in our modern thought. They really are the first to bring it forward and get us to think in republican terms. And that kind of thinking is with us to the current day. Deep in the heart of our political tradition, in other words, we find precisely the kind of competing visions of protective republicanism and developmental republicanism. And that thinking will play itself out in the way in which we envision democracy over time. And in some ways, that same debate is with us today. If we think about things like direct action, political protest, new forms of politics, very often these are revivals of discussions about protective and developmental forms of political rule. Is representation a useful form of political structure, or do people need to be directly involved in politics for it to have any meaningful effect? Next day, we'll move on to liberalism, and we'll start to look at the ways in which our liberal thinking in the current age and our liberal notions of what democratic governance mean, we'll look at the ways in which those are founded in political thinking. And it's political thinking that, in fact, emerges out of this republican tradition.